Joel Pollack, senior editor at Breitbart and our go-to man on all important stories in the United States, joins us, I suppose around midnight your time. Joel, thank you for being with us very early morning our time. Big developments, and maybe before we unpack the relevance of it, could you just explain how the American legal or political system works, i.e. that you've got a House of Representatives and a Senate, and what that means for lawmaking?
Well, we have a bicameral legislature, and if you visit Washington and you go to the Capitol building, they're on opposite sides of the building. There's the central rotunda in the middle, and then one side is the House, and the other side is the Senate. And the House is considered the lower chamber. It is composed of 435 representatives, and the representatives are apportioned by population. So California has the most, with 52, and many states that have fewer than the minimum threshold only have one representative. The Senate, on the other side, has 100 senators, two from every state, and those two are regardless of population. So California has two, Wyoming has two, doesn't really matter. The Senate is considered the upper house. However, the House of Representatives, the lower house, has certain powers the Senate does not. For example, all taxation bills have to originate in the House, and only the House can vote to declare war. And the reason the framers of the Constitution put those powers in the lower house is that the lower house, because it's popularly elected, is thought to be closer to the people. And the framers of the American Constitution wanted the weighty decision of going to war and raising taxes to be closer to the people, who would have to bear the burden of those commitments. The Senate is the upper house, and whereas representatives in the House of Representatives only serve 2 years, the senators serve six. So they don't have to worry about re-election quite so often. And they have some powers that members of the House of Representatives don't have. One of the unique functions of the Senate, for example, is to act as a court, a court in impeachment trials. The House can indict, that is to say, the House can lay a charge, and the Senate must sit as a court to convict or acquit. The Senate also has the power of advising and consenting to presidential appointees at a certain level. So you'll often see that nominees for ambassadorships or cabinet positions have to go through the Senate for a confirmation vote. Same with judges and Supreme Court justices. And then the Senate has certain foreign policy powers. All treaties have to be ratified by a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate. So the Senate actually exercises some foreign policy powers that the House of Representatives does not. The House of Representatives has some oversight of foreign policy, but it's really almost a form of commentary, perhaps investigation to some extent, but it's very limited on foreign policy. The Senate has rather far-reaching foreign policy powers, and the senators who serve in the capacity of members of the Foreign Relations Committee or the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee are thought to have quite a lot of influence on foreign policy, even within the executive. So, for example, Marco Rubio and Joe Biden, familiar names to South Africans, were both senior members of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, or Foreign Relations Committee. They have different names in the House and the Senate. I may be confusing them. In the process of preparing legislation, generally for most matters, a bill can originate in either house, and once it passes one house, it then goes to the other, and it has to be voted on in that house. Now, if there are amendments such that the legislation becomes different in either house, then they form a conference committee to reconcile the differences between the two pieces of legislation, and they vote on one common bill in either house. Once both houses have passed a piece of legislation, it then goes to the president's desk for signature, and he has a certain period of time in which to either sign the legislation or veto the legislation. So that's generally how it works. Now, what's happened this week with regard to South Africa, which is significant, is that there had been for a long time a bill in the House of Representatives by Representative Ronnie Jackson of Texas that would call for a review of bilateral relations with South Africa. And no one really paid it that much attention here because many of those bills never make it out of the House. A lot of members of the House propose legislation all the time that has no hope of going anywhere. It's mostly for show, either because they have some constituency they want to appease by saying, look, I went to Washington and I fought for this for you. I even introduced legislation about whatever it was. It doesn't matter whether it passed or not. They just want to be seen as having taken a stand. But once that legislation also has a counterpart in the Senate, it means that there's a serious effort underway to build support, not just in one House, but in both. And that's the precursor to passing a bill, because if you can pass it in both houses, then you can get it to the president's desk. And what happened this week was Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, who's a very senior senator, introduced a bill that is almost exactly the same as Ronny Jackson's bill, calling for a review of bilateral relations with South Africa. So suddenly, instead of a vanity project by people who have a particular interest in South Africa, this now looks like it's moving toward an actual foreign policy step taken by the government of the United States.
Yeah, that is pretty serious. What is interesting, he's from Louisiana, and that's where Sasol has got its big plant. At the time, it was the biggest foreign investor. So I guess he knows South Africa better than perhaps other senators. Thanks for giving us that background, Joel, because as you know, in South Africa, we don't really understand the process. But I guess this is a very significant development in the approach towards South Africa by the United States on a foreign policy level.
It is, because if you have the Congress, which is elected by the people, passing this kind of legislation, it does mean that the anger with the direction of South Africa's foreign and domestic policies is no longer confined to this particular Trump administration. It means it reflects the will of the American people more broadly. That's much harder to contend with. And there have been Democrats who've been disappointed in South Africa's drift over the last few years. The Biden administration, of course, picked a bone with South Africa over its apparent support, at least in the early stages, for Russia in the war with Ukraine. And the Republicans, of course, have come in and complained about the process of land expropriation or the Expropriation Act, as well as many other issues. And this bill lists all of those grievances from either side in explaining why there should be a bilateral review of relations. Now, what do these bills actually say? Well, they provide a legislative framework for sanctions on the ANC, for sanctions on other parties, for sanctions on members of the South African government individually. It also provides that South Africa should essentially be cut off from the African Growth and Opportunity Act, although I think if the tariffs that President Trump has put into place remain in place, then AGOA has probably been superseded anyway. But it also calls for various other penalties and changes in bilateral relations. And so this really is a significant piece of legislation and talks about China, talks about the Middle East, and talks about South Africa's domestic policies. And there are a few differences in the legislation. Interestingly, the House version is a little bit more specific about factions of the ANC, and the Senate version is more sweeping, simply saying that the ANC as a whole is responsible for a lot of the mess. And it's interesting. I wonder why that text was written differently in either house. But anyway, they will reconcile those two texts, assuming that this bill passes. Now, we don't know if it's going to pass. Generally, before a bill can come to the floor for a vote, it has to go through a legislative committee. And the legislative committee will debate the bill and will change the bill, will invite amendments and so forth. They'll have what they call a markup session where they get into the nuts and bolts of the legislation. Then finally, it'll be prepared on the floor. So that's a long process, and it's not guaranteed that a bill would make it through that process, even if it has some support in both houses. But the fact that both houses now are considering similar legislation is a very important sign.
Sure, it really is. It's, I suppose, one of those things that if it's that hard to get it enacted, it's going to be very difficult to get it repealed as well at some point in future. Joel, if you were advising, and you know South Africa well, and you know the opposition politics well, if you were advising the people in the Western Cape, because we are hearing this more and more, they should, from people who say they should get onto a plane from the Western Cape, go to Washington, go and say to Washington, we are not ANC, we are not part of this mess. treat us differently if it be through exports, etc. Is that ever got a chance of flying, given now that the pressure is ratcheting up?
I don't think so. But look, if I were advising the South African government, this may surprise you, but I would give slightly different advice to the advice I'd given before. So most of the year during all these disputes, I said South Africa needs to come to the table with concessions. I still think that's true. But if I'm honest, and I try to be, I would also say that South Africa should prepare to give concessions, but should wait. And what South Africa should wait for is a very important case that's made its way to the Supreme Court in the United States, which has to do with the legality of the tariffs. If Congress had passed the tariffs, they would be legal. There wouldn't be a question. The president enacted some of these tariffs using his emergency powers, and it's an open question as to whether he actually did so properly. So it is possible that some of the tariffs that South Africa is worried about could be at least temporarily lifted if the Supreme Court decides that the president exceeded his powers. It's not clear what the outcome of the case will be. And if I were advising the Trump administration, I would say it's important to reach trade deals before this case is heard at the Supreme Court. It's going to be heard in November. And you want to arrive at as many deals as possible in the event that the case goes the other way and the tariffs are thrown out. Trump is really making a very strong case, or at least a very energetic case, that the court would be ill-advised to reverse his tariffs for various economic reasons. But it could happen. It could happen. It doesn't mean that the tariffs in and of themselves are illegal, but he may have construed a statute that was passed in the 1970s more broadly than it had been intended. And so there's actually quite a strong case against the Trump tariffs on that basis. So I would advise the South African government to wait, but to have concessions prepared in the event that the Supreme Court of the United States does throw out the tariffs, at least temporarily, because South Africa is not out of the woods yet. And you can see from this bilateral legislation that South Africa could then find itself isolated as one of the only countries facing tariffs, because if both houses of the Congress can agree that South Africa is violating its pledges not to support anti-American policies, and if it's interfering in American interests around the globe, it's not going to be hard to summon enough support in both houses to apply tariffs to South Africa, as Congress wishes to do in that case. So I would say it's not too late, but time is running out. You have some time, but I would, again, focus on those changes that are both demanded by the Trump administration and good for South Africa. So that's where the attention would be. And I think it doesn't help that South Africa is supporting the International Criminal Court. It doesn't help that South Africa, again, is supporting Iran. I mean, some of the gestures toward Iran have been ridiculous. And it doesn't help that South Africa is cozying up to China, I mean, continuously. So we'll see where all of this goes. There's been some improvement, I think. And I think the South African judiciary has finally ruled against Julius Malema on the genocidal language that Trump highlighted at the Oval Office meeting with Cyril Ramaphosa. But if I were advising the South African government, I'd say take your time, at least until this tariff case is settled, see how that shakes out. But be ready, if it does go against the president, to be a friend and not to gloat or to opine on whether he acted lawfully or not, because Congress could just as easily slap the tariffs on South Africa and South Africa alone. So I would say be ready, be a friend in that moment to the administration and say, well, we understand that the tariffs have been temporarily at least restored to what they were before, but look, this is an opportunity to repair the relationship, to build a new relationship and so forth. Now, I am hearing rumors here in Washington that there are some chances of a trade deal anyway. I mean, I'm hearing that there's some optimism that there may be some kind of a deal in the works. And that could reflect the Trump administration's sudden pressure from the courts. I mean, they may be in a rush now to conclude whatever trade agreements they can before the courts take away their leverage, at least temporarily, by saying that the tariffs were unlawfully enacted. And again, I would say that's more likely than not, probably a 60% chance to 40% against. So who knows? I mean, these are just rumors, and we'll see. But certainly the broader concerns with the drift of South African policy remain in place.
Joel, I know you need to get to bed very soon, but just one final question. We might have been looking at your appointment as the ambassador to South Africa. We know that that's not the case anymore. But Brett Brazel, there's also talk here that he will be going through the different official channels soon. Are you getting any feedback on that at all? Because the U.S. still does not have an ambassador in South Africa.
Right now, there is a holdup in the Senate. So the Senate, again, has this power of advising and consenting to presidential appointees. And something like 300 appointments are being held up at the moment. And Democrats are using various procedural maneuvers. Republicans are in the majority in both houses, Democrats in the minority. In the Senate, the minority has very strong powers to resist the majority. But what sometimes happens is they use those powers unwisely to antagonize the majority, and then the majority can simply change the rules of the Senate almost at will, which it looks like the Republicans are going to do. They're going to change the rules of voting procedure on these nominees to hurry them through. Because, as you point out, it's not good to have all these ambassadorships unfilled. And so I think the Senate is going to fast-track a lot of these appointments once that's done. And, you know, that's a double-edged sword because the Democrats will control the Senate again one day, of course, and they'll push all of their nominees through, and they'll do so without the opposition that Republicans might like to be able to provide. But anyway, that's where we are right now. And by the way, that's how Republicans were able to put so many justices on the Supreme Court, because Democrats, about a decade ago, decided that they didn't want to have to convince Republicans to support their nominees. They didn't want to have to go through this lengthy process of scrutiny and have Republicans holding up the nominations. So they changed the rules to allow an easier process for judicial nominees. Well, as soon as Trump became president, he used that same rule and put his justices on the Supreme Court very quickly. So it is a double-edged sword. And there's a kind of collegiality that the Senate requires to work properly, where senators agree not to do this sort of thing to each other, not to hold up all the appointees. But the Senate Minority Leader, a man named Chuck Schumer of New York, who really is a politician's politician, is under extreme pressure from his own state and from his party to show a little more backbone when it comes to opposing Trump. And so he's doing this somewhat self-defeating thing, holding up the nominations. But I do think most of those nominations will go through by the end of the year and be confirmed.
Joel Pollack, Senior Editor at Breitbart. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.